on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is Five Live.
Paul Hardy, who's one of our Tokyo listeners.
One of the many,
yes,
apparently.
That's right. Absolutely loads.
We are big in Japan.
Since Mr. Kermode's been in Japan, you could ask him to bring you back something useful, such as sock glue or a beetle polishing kit. Now, I'm not. I read it out just because I'm not. Are they things that are big in Japan?
I didn't come across
sock glue.
No, I didn't come across either sock glue or a beetle polishing kit. I mean, it is all the cliches that you hear that, you know, that there are vending machines on every corner that will sell you almost anything. I mean, actually, the thing that was most surprising to me was that it is impossible to ever be knowingly undercaked in Tokyo, or in fact, all Japan. Wherever you go, it's like there's a cakes concession with it. So it's a train station, but cakes. Or, you know, violin shop with cakes. And then there'll be something, you know, so water with cakes. And you can go to... We went to Kyoto, you know, and as well as Tokyo, which, as my son pointed out, it's the same word, only in the letters in the other order. And you go to, like, you know, a 600-year-old temple, and there'll be a machine selling cakes. It's just weird. There are just cakes, absolutely. So at no point would you ever be any more than about 40 yards away from a packet of freshly hand-wrapped cakes. And, of course, I'm not a small man at the best of times. But on the flight back, I was, you know, almost needing to occupy two seats because of the cake consumption.
And is it like
just
a
massive
Victoria cream sponge?
It's like the kind of cakes you wouldn't...
Ginger cake? Or?
I'll tell you how all-pervasively cakey it is. I went into a 24-hour store that was called something like 24-hour store. And I bought what was clearly a loaf of bread, you know, a roll of bread, like a small French bread, because I thought it'd be good for breakfast in the morning. When you break it open, it's got cream and jam inside it. It's actually a cake disguised as a piece of bread. I mean, it was just cake-tastic. I saw a thing went into a newsagent, bought a couple of things which I thought they were badges. They were cakes that you could clip onto your lapels. I mean, lapel cake. So in case, say you're on the Tokyo subway, I'm between stop 38 and 39, feel a bit undercaked. I'll just eat like that. It was amazing levels of cakes.
So you've come back the size of a house.
Well,
did you bring a kimono back, by the way?
Yeah. Of course I did.
I'm disappointed that you're not wearing it.
You're not really disappointed. No, you're not. You're actually secretly relieved because I almost did. I brought you something back as well, but I haven't brought it in today, which is really annoying.
Was it sock glue or a beetle polishing kit?
No, it's a cake.
Oh, well, that would have been the obvious time to mention it.
When?
And bring it in.
Yes, I know, but I'll drag it out for next week.
It's the audio equivalent of holiday slides. Anyway,
here are some of the cakes that we saw. My good friend, my very good friend Trevor, who I was out there with, Trevor and Tommy. Tommy is Japanese, and they got married in Japan, and he came back with the album of wedding photographs, and the album of photographs was photographs of the food. It wasn't like photographs of groups of people. It was photographs of the food.
My guess is we won't get through the box office top 10 before 3, but we'll start now at 10, State of Play.
Well, you know, the poignancy of poor old David Morrissey loitering outside, unable to go in because it's the wedding of the girlfriend he still loves, has somewhat undercut the popcorn enjoyment that I had. But I did. Have you seen it yet?
Yes.
You liked it enough, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely.
But it's not the TV show, although the TV show is apparently available for like thrumpence and you can get all of it. All 6 hours of it.
On one DVD. The Ghost of Girlfriends Past, this was number 9.
Well, it's on the way out, and so presumably it's paid Matthew Mahogany's bills for the next year or so, which should mean that he can go and do something more interesting. Can I remind you, as I always like to, that Matthew Mahogany's earliest starring role, I can remember, was alongside Renee Zellweger in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 4.
Tormented is at 8.
We were sitting in this very studio, and there was the guy who wrote Stormbreaker, Anthony Horowitz, whose play, he wrote a play which was incidentally performed on off-Broadway, recently directed by Ken Russell. Just thought I'd throw that in.
Yes.
And next to him was Alex Pettifer, who at that point was young and chirpy and said please and thank you. Playing Alex Rider. Now, he said, obviously wants to sort of scuffle himself up a bit. So it's an American, it's an American high school revenge movie in which at the beginning of the movie, the nerd has died. Then all the bullies and people who took pleasure in bullying him are all picked off in horrible ways. The problem with it is, and this will be relevant when we get to Drag Me to Hell, it can't decide whether it wants to be scary or funny. It ends up being goofy, and goofy isn't really great for horror. I wanted it to be more, and it just kept sort of pulling its punches by just settling for being a bit goofy.
And we have Fighting at 7,
which
Channing Tatum.
Yeah, you liked him, and you said he was a bit of a southern gentleman and a little bit like Elvis. And it's a funny old movie because it's on the one hand, a very, very straightforward street movie about a guy who's a hustler and, you know, he meets this young kid and he says, oh, you could be a street fighter, and he becomes a fighter, and an uninteresting plot. On the other hand, it has the kind of, you know, how to, Guide to Recognising Your Saints and Saturday Night Fever streetwise feel that's quite charming in places. I mean, it's a much better movie than the plot synopsis would make you think.
Hannah Montana the Movie is at number six.
Which, for me, wasn't as entertaining as Hannah Montana versus Miley Cyrus in the Best of Both Worlds 3D live on stage, which again is going to be relevant because during the Hannah Montana 3D live on stage concert movie, there's a brief performance by the Jonas Brothers, who have now become so big that they have their own 3D concert experience movie, which I've seen this morning and which we shall review in a moment.
Yes, we certainly shall. And also the Jonas Brothers kind of turn up in Night at the Museum too, as singing
the cherubs. Yeah, I have to say, I hadn't noticed that that was the Jonas Brothers. Did you notice it? Because you recognised their voices?
They'd appeared once and then they appeared the second time, and I thought, oh, right, that's them.
That's the Jonas Brothers. Because you interviewed the Jonas Brothers.
Well, we had a conversation, yeah, which lasted a certain amount of time, and we broadcast about a tenth of it.
OK, well, we'll come to that when we do the 3D movie experience.
It's Coraline's at five, part of an email from Laura King, just on the 3D aspect of Coraline. Mm. She says she and her husband went to see Coraline, they, you know, they loved it, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, she makes this point. Unfortunately, she says, the 3D glasses were not designed for my non-Caucasian nose, and I had to prop the glasses up throughout the entire film. This left my hand tired, my eyes wobbly, and me somewhat distracted from the wonderful story. I recently saw Monsters vs. Aliens in New York and found the glasses to be much better designed for noses of all races, and wish that the O2 cinemas could follow suit. I knew instantly that I must write to your good selves and hope that you might read this email on air to urge the powers that be to amend this woefully unfair situation as soon as possible.
Right, this is a pair of real 3D glasses.
Yes.
When I put them on, and I have
is it Roy
really
Orbison?
Weird, it is, yes. I drove all night.
Well, now you see, now
when I put them on, do they fit my nose? Because mine, yeah. I have a really stupid nose. I have the kind of cake thing on the end with a bent bit in the middle, and they sit very uncomfortably on my nose. But I find all glasses sit uncomfortably on my nose.
A treat for the live stream viewers.
What I'm wondering is,
you look ridiculous.
But and how do the glasses make that look any different? What I'm wondering is, how does the non-Caucasianness of the nose, is it that it's too thin, that she was holding on because it's propping? What is it that's... Okay, fine.
Anyway, but Laura's point is that the 3D glasses that you get with Coraline are designed for Caucasian noses only.
Okay, I mean, I'm not entirely sure that my nose is any form of regular shape. But in the end, it's not the nose thing that matters. What matters is the strength of the arms on the ears, right? Because, in fact, you like that. They're not even touching my
nose. All right, that's enough of that.
I was going to say, but one last thing. Yeah. On the subject of 3D,
yeah.
Sam Mendes said recently, he was asked by, I think it was Empire magazine, would he be making films in 3D? He said, I already have done. It's called theatre.
And we'd worked our way from numbers 10 to number 5, which was Coraline. And that 3D debate continues. But we have X-Men Oranges. X-Men Oranges.
Yes.
Which actually would be a nice place to go next. But it's the Wolverine movie at number 4.
Which is boring and, you know, nothing like as exciting and interesting as it should be.
Star Trek at number 3, 8.
The debate continues, doesn't it, on the virtues of Star Trek?
I went to see Star Trek eagerly looking forward to some thought-provoking sci-fi drama in keeping with Gene Roddenberry's vision. What I got was 2 hours... a bad guy trying to blow up planets while the Star Trek team try and stop them. Starfleet are no longer explorers, they're now a peacekeeping armada, not unlike Thunderbirds, scrambled to trouble spots, travelling at the speed of plot. Then at the close of the film, I quite like that line, then at the close of the film, their mission is to seek out strange new worlds, again with no explanation. We are given no idea who runs them or what they are about. All the potential of a making prequel is thrown away with the film's eagerness to get everyone back in position. Are we so desperate to see the Star Trek brand popular again that we're prepared to jettison anything thought-provoking or consistent? Steve in London. Dear Bert and Ernie, I need to chastise Dr. Kermode for jumping on the bandwagon with Star Trek. The film does not reinvigorate or reinvent the franchise. Cloverfield did do that for Godzilla. Star Trek is trash for Trekkies, and everyone should just admit that they're Trekkies instead of pretending that they're not, yet loving this film nonetheless.
Hang on, I'm not a Trekkie. I mean, I was, you know, I had an interest in Star Trek as a kid. I mean, I know more about Captain Pike than perhaps I should do, and I could tell you the names of the episodes that, you know, that the pilot was divided between. But after that, I lost interest. Certainly was never interested in The Next Generation or the new diddly bong or any of that stuff. Not interested at all. In fact, I find most Trekkiness completely boring. But it did reinvigorate the franchise. I mean, it gives me no great pleasure to be able to say, oh, Star Trek is alive and well. Because, I mean, I would refer you, incidentally, to my review in Time Out several years ago of Star Trek V, the one in which they go to heaven and beat up God, which I thought was a right royal kicking. I have no reverence for Star Trek at all. I just liked the Star Trek movie. Sorry, that's the way it is.
Steve Penny. Oh, no, we'll get to this correspondence in a moment, because it's all about Night at the Museum 2. Angels and Demons at number 2, no correspondence.
Stupidest
at
movie.
All.
Really?
None. Well, we have done it. As far as I'm aware,
none.
No one's going to
say. Stupidest movie ever made. And can I just say, on the plane back from Japan, I watched in the actor's studio, interview with Tom Hanks, in the actor's studio, in which people are given the most oleaginous treatment by, I can't remember what the guy's name is, and they had Tom Hanks in, and it was just around the release of The Da Vinci Code, so they were being terribly reverent about The Da Vinci Code, and they were able to show a couple of clips from it before realising the howl of indignation that would greet that movie. And I had forgotten just how awful it was. And there was a couple of moments, and they showed some clips from The Da Vinci Code with Audrey Tautou. Oh, yes, Audrey Tautou. Oh, I'm so French. And I have to say that it is true that the thing about Angels and Demons is it is funnier than The Da Vinci Code.
So we get to Night at the Museum 2, which is at number 1. So Steve Penny on this.
Dear, as we said it would be.
Indeed. Dear all-knowing... It wasn't a particularly prophetic remark, though, was it?
In that it was in advance of it happening and it was completely correct. I think that is prophetic, isn't it?
Following on a movie that took a gazillion dollars, I think it was.
Yeah,
and it being half-term.
No, but, you know, as has just been demonstrated, it's becoming now a standing gag with it, but bring Mark on to insult people's movies.
Anyway, Steve Penny, who I've introduced 3 times now, says, Dear all-knowing Norman and Mr. Caboo, which proves that he's an ancient listener.
Mm-hmm. Very ancient.
I took my 7-year-old daughter to see Night at the Museum 2 last Friday, and we both enjoyed it in our own ways. I enjoyed the various cameos, Steve Coogan and Owen Wilson, Bill Hader as a vain General Custer, and Jonah Hill as the overzealous security guard, all had me chuckling, and my daughter giggled whenever Hank Azaria's Kamun Ra was speaking in that extraordinary Willis Wodger-style voice.
Roderick.
I'm just saying Willis Wodger is what he says. So I'm quoting Steve Penny. Okay. 2 thoughts occupied me as I left the cinema, however. The first was that Dr. Kermode was right when he said it was further proof of the death of narrative cinema.
Good.
I said as much to my daughter, age 7, who was right when... who, remember, is 7. And she gave the pithy response, Daddy, you're weird. The other was that Amy Adams looked fantastic in a pair of jodhpurs, which I suspect will have occurred to a number of people.
Did people think that?
What?
That Amy Adams looked fantastic in the jodhpurs?
On balance, yes.
Did you think that?
On balance, yes. Did that not occur to you?
No, I mean, I like Amy Adams, but that's... I've got to say that the Eric von Stroheim trousers didn't really do it for me.
Kai, who's a future architect, fingers crossed, says, George and Lenny went to see Night at Museum 2 yesterday with my friends. With the arrival of Napoleon, Genghis Khan and other historical figures, it reminded me less of less funny version of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. The film itself was absolute rubbish, but I was consoled at the end when Life in Technicolor 1 by Coldplay was used as the soundtrack for the slow talking bit at the very end of the movie. At least the sound editors had some taste, even if the scripters didn't.
Coldplay are terrible.
Coldplay are great.
Coldplay are like U2's, you know, illegitimate progeny, aren't they?
It's Jeremy...
That whingy bloke and his funny notations drawn on the back of his hand because he's incredibly worried about the planet.
Jeremy Dillon, age 19, in Sydney, Australia. Dear Elvis Costello and the Attractions. Dear, with your glasses, actually, you're going to have to be Elvis and I'll have to be an attraction.
Yeah. Oh, I just don't know where to be.
You can follow this live stream should you wish to see that. And lots of live pictures on this show next week, by the way.
I've just embarrassed myself.
Not for the first time.
No, for the first time I've ever blushed. I've done something and then thought I wish I hadn't done it.
Do an Elvis impression. Yeah. Dear Elvis in the Attractions, says Jeremy in Sydney, saw Night at the Museum 2, The Heretic, last night.
Very good. Very good.
What a mess. A cacophony of cartoon CGI and comic caterwauling. On the positive side, Amy Adams' Kate Hepburn impression was delightful, as was Hank Azaria's bit a spot on Boris Karloff. Otherwise, mostly awful. Still, not as bad as Dance Flick. What's that then?
Don't know. Dance Flick.
Was that an Australian thing, was it, particularly?
Strictly.
Jeremy, get back in touch. The Summer.
starts here. June on 5 Live and 5 Live Sports Extra. The Derby.
Riding away for all his worth.
World 2020 Cricket. The Turkish and British Grand Prix. World Cup qualifiers. Phil Tufnell and Gethin Jones return to 5 Live. Special coverage of the local elections in England and the European elections. Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode's film review. Live in Edinburgh. For full programme listings, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
I'd forgotten that. We're live in Edinburgh.
And for anyone in the cinema, we'll be in 3D.
That's true. June the 19th, and we're going to broadcast the programme in 3D on the radio.
Yes, oral 3D.
With special guests.
Yes. What's this shrugging for?
Because I suspect a special guest who we both know about.
Yeah.
But it probably won't happen.
No.
This guest is so big, it can't possibly happen.
No, it's not happening.
Oh, it's not happening?
No.
Well, why didn't you tell me that?
Well, we haven't. I've been in Japan, you know.
So that big guest that I mean, I only agreed to do it on the basis that the big guest was going to be there.
No, on the basis of my invitation.
What happened?
I don't know. We probably shouldn't be having this conversation on air.
Why not? Let's inform the audience.
Yeah.
Why?
No. Don't even. In the same way as you told me not to, let's not.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we'll say hello.
Do your dirty laundry in public.
Let's say hello to
Jason Isaacs.
Jason Isaacs, who performs a mean card trick.
Yeah, I heard that you were in a pub with Jason Isaacs.
Well, no, just sitting on the grass.
Oh, okay. And what card trick was it?
I can't really explain it.
No,
but you need a fellow performer.
Oh right, okay.
He's very, very good.
He is very, very good at everything. He sent me a message saying, "Where are you?" And I felt like saying, "I'm in Japan."
Which is a pretty good answer.
Yeah, very good
and
answer.
And David Morrissey, hello to him, and hello to Stephen Fry and assorted members
of Fairport Convention.
Michael Sheen as well. Has he been? I'm confused as to whether he's admitted to the Hall of Fame or not.
Well, I'll have him if he'll. He has to officially say that he wants to.
Okay.
I think so. But
he tweets to that effect.
Yeah, yeah.
You can follow.
And Alan Davis, if he decides that I'm not like the sound of cheese graters on his ears.
If you want to follow this on an almost daily basis, now with added Kermode tweeting, it's twitter.com and you follow at Wittertainment. Glenn in Tokyo, thank you. Now I have the excuse. It's the cakes. I came to Japan in 86 weighing 10 stone. I'm now 15 stone.
There we go.
I also take photos of food. And here is a photo just for Mark.
Of food. There we are.
Photo of some cake, which I'll hold up to. I'll just hold it at the camera.
The mint green tea, the green tea Kit Kat, which I'll just
living in the UK for 15 years. Dr. K seems to be shocked by one of our six has been chocolate bed.
Yes, we are over chocolate bed and undercaked. The thing we don't have in common is the transport system that works.
We have gone on long enough without discussing Jonas Brothers. The Jonas Brothers have a 3D...
I have been genuinely wrestling with the Jonas Brothers because I went to see the Hannah Montana 3D movie and I did enjoy it. It was good fun. I liked the songs. I liked the concert in 3D. I liked it more than U2 in 3D. There was a brief appearance in that by Jonas Brothers, who are the new Disney sort of Stepford band. And they're also got their own series coming up. Now, I knew that you'd interviewed them and that you perhaps didn't think that they were deep.
Well, I was interested to discover... this week, also interviewed with you two, and I had the same experience.
Really?
Set it all up by saying, this isn't the greatest interview that you're ever going to hear. That there were some technical issues, which there were when we were doing it.
Okay.
But they're still answering. They're going to say things that they want to say, and if you ask anything interesting to them, they really can't cope.
Okay. Because when Smiley Virus, the Jonas Brothers, it was a little bit scary, but it was quite entertainingly weird. Whereas what you're saying about the Jonas Brothers was it was just, you know, it was just a... Now, so I, on the one hand, I'm trying to be open about this because I can't stand the idea that of old people like me, I mean, I'm in my mid-40s, saying, oh, pop music, it's not what it used to be. Okay, because pop music is for young people and for them to decide, you know, what's good and what's bad. And who cares what your dad's had it? And clearly, this is Disney, it's a Disney product, right? It is a Disney product. It's aimed at, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-olds.
Well, I think a bit old. I mean, teenage girls, I think, because I...
Well, apparently so. I was about to say, actually, when you see the film, the screaming, adoring fans are teenage girls as opposed to 8, 9, 10-year-olds. They are slightly older than I thought. So the first thing I want to say is, on the subject of the music, here's a little clip of the Jonas Brothers music. And forgive me, but is this not actually not very good pop music? I feel so bad, so fast, yeah, myself, mean, it's not busted, is it? And in fact, even
is that the standard? I think it is.
It is. No, I think it's not. I mean, I think that
is better than busted.
Would you think they're better than busted? I think busted is kind of the gold star of the, you know, the young person's Thunderbird theme, you know, something for everyone power pop.
Well.
No,
I don't know. It's, it's a difficult comparison.
No, it's not, because it's the kind of you know, three broadsheets, right? Oh, it's this stupid pop, you know, made by Disney, blah, 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 blah. But you have to judge this for the audience for whom it is, and that's what I'm wrestling with. Firstly, I don't think the music is very good. To some extent, you could say they're the modern Monkees. The difference between them and the Monkees is that they write their own songs. I mean, I stayed to the end of the credits, and certainly their names are credited on the songs. Hence, the songs aren't actually that good. I mean, the thing with the Monkees, they didn't write their own songs. They didn't play on most of them. The song's brilliant. They got in really brilliant songwriters like Neil Diamond, all that. But they got in, you know, great musicians. I mean, if you look at things like What Am I Doing Hanging Around, I mean, they were playing a little bit and they were singing a little bit. And then later on in their career, Round Time Headquarters, they kind of took over and wanted to do more of their own stuff. But there was the thing, when they were constructed as a bubblegum pop band, they had brilliant composers. And I was thinking, if this is the modern Monkees, then we have lost something, because there's no Daydream Believers in there. There isn't anything. Thing that's I mean, even like Shades of Grey, there's nothing that has that kind of classic ring to it. I don't know that in 20 years time people will be listening in afternoon radio to, oh, here's so and so by the Jonas Brothers.
It's
and
going, McFly. It is.
Oh, McFly are quite a good decent band.
I didn't come out of the Jonas Brothers thinking that it was awful. If this is the kind, you know, if you are 14, you're going to like
Simon,
it.
Simon, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's awful. That's the point. I mean, obviously it's not awful because it's an incredibly professional show. For a start, they've got an army of musicians on stage. They're all sort of variously playing and changing guitars, but you're sure that if any of them stop playing or changing guitars, you wouldn't notice. The music would obviously carry on. There's a larger bloke with a hat who's clearly doing all the fiddly guitar work. There's always one other guy doing the drums. There's an army of people on stage with cellos and violins. And in fact, there's one scene of them sound checking, which they appear to be sound checking to a backing track. And I'm sure that they may be musically competent. And there's one tantalising moment in the film when they go into a radio, so to go and do an acoustic session. But then you never see the acoustic session. I was thinking, this is going to be the moment when they suddenly demonstrate they can play the banjo and they can do all that other stuff. Because, like, for example, you know, most country and western musicians, great country and western musicians, who at the age of, you know, Dolly Parton's family, at the age of 14, there wasn't a single one of them that couldn't play an Appalachian nose flute while twiddling a banjo and playing an accordion behind their neck, because everybody did that. And I'm sure that the Jonas Brothers come from some tradition of that, but there was no evidence of it in the movie. You kept thinking, at any point, if their guitars fell off or something, you wouldn't notice. Point number one. Point number two.
That was just point number one.
Point number two. As far as the three. No, I want to do this seriously. Point number two. Three. Okay. Point number two. As far as the 3D romping around concert footage is concerned, okay, what the 3D does is, as Bonio said, puts you on stage with a band. In the case of U2, can't be bothered. In the case of this, fine, because we don't get sanctimonious lectures. But the 3D effect is largely
that hug has worn off, hasn't it?
Running forward to the front of the stage and running backwards, and then running and tumbling forward to the front of the stage, and then running and tumbling backwards, occasionally somersaulting, and then at one point they stand on podiums that go up in the air. And they stand on podiums like that, and then the podiums come down. I was quite afeard for their safety, but then it turned out they had harnesses on that sort of attached them to the podiums like dolls. Like they were literally life-size doll versions of themselves. And so there was a whole weird Stepford thing going on, and yet they're obviously, you know, nice young kids. I'm sure they're nice. I hope they're nice. One of them, the singer guy, annoys me a little bit because he's a bit full of it and he's desperate. He's doing a sort of rather...
Is that the... there's curly-haired Jonas and there's two straight-haired
there's
Jonas.
There's Kevin, who looks like Michael Nesmith, and therefore I liked him because, you know, Michael...
He's got a woolly hat on?
No, he's got curly hair.
Oh,
and the side is like that. There's the guy who looks like Kinani Nunu with the straight hair, who's always got the cap t-shirt and is very, very pleased with himself. And he's doing that romping around stage in the sub Bob Geldof doing an impression of Mick Jagger.
But
you know, there's an awful lot of walking like that, you know. No, there's an awful,
mincing.
Yeah, but that kind of, that a lot of that, a lot of the, hey, look, but I'm not singing anything at the moment, so I'll just do a little bit of walk. And a lot of sort of rampaging crowds. And, of course, the thing that everybody knows about the Jonas Brothers is that they are, you know, they're...
Not very good?
No, not that. Is that they're, in theory, well-behaved, pristine, you know, clean-cut boys.
Yes. Dad's
so
a minister.
So when my daughter went to see Avril Lavigne, and they were the support
act. She's not clean-cut.
No, she's my daughter. They were the support act, right? And so at one point, she said that the guy, the straight-haired guy, went to the front of the stage, poured a bottle of water over his head, and shook his locks like this. So the water sprayed out.
I'm going to try that.
And nobody was quite sure. There is a moment in the Jonas Brothers 3D movie. You've seen the movie, right?
Yes, I think that's
been in which the Jonas Brothers stand at the front of the stage in 3D... and spray the crowd with foam.
Yeah?
I'm just going to put that on the table. I'm just going to leave because they stand.
You're going to put it on the table
because
for?
they come out to the front of the crowd.
Yeah,
and they've got their the foam guns.
Yeah,
and the foam sprays.
Crazy foam, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, now you've put it on the table.
No, I'm not going. Here's what it is. I'm not going anywhere near. I'm inviting the audience to fill in the blanks for themselves. What I'm saying is there is a really strange thing going on between, on the one hand...
You're weird.
No, I'm not weird. I'm not weird. I'm saying that there is this...
If you're going to be sprayed with something, what would you rather be sprayed with? Foam from a Jonas Brother or your beer and spit? Because someone's told a funny
joke.
What
would I rather be sprayed with?
Yeah.
My beer and spit. It's the thing is that in the end, the whole point about the rock and roll performance with the low slung guitars and the bragging around and the waving your, you know, your booty in the air and the spraying the audience with the creamy foam gun is all slightly... It's
slightly what? What is it slightly?
It's just slightly troubling is what it is.
Well,
and here's the honest truth of it. I had less trouble with Hannah Montana than I did with the Jonas Brothers. And then there were a couple of cameo appearances by that woman out of Camp Rock, and the blonde woman who sings the song with the woman going mad with the violin.
It just occurs to me we've talked about this film for too
no,
long.
No, I know, but it's going
to
be
out of all proportion to its.
Okay, well, I feel that I have done it justice, and I feel what I didn't want to do was what every other broadsheet review is doing, which is going, "Oh, Jonas Brothers," you know. No, you have to. It's pop music. You have to look at it in terms of who it's aimed at, right? I saw it in the Whiteley Cinema today with six other people, and they seemed to think it was fine. And at the end of the movie, the Jonas Brothers all point at the screen. They point their fingers out at the screen. They say, "You." And I felt that I was being personally pointed at and sprayed at by the Jonas
You're
Brothers.
You're easily impressed.
I am, yes.
Yeah, so if you like that kind of thing, that's the kind of thing you'll like. That's what it boils down to.
Yeah, but it doesn't. There's more to it than that.
Dear Rayman and Tootsie, I referred to my text last week when I got stuck in a bizarre Jonas Brothers time loop due to a broken projector at my local multiplex. After this hideous event, I vowed never to have anything to do with the insidious trio of brothers, so imagine my dismay when they popped up as sickly sweet cherubs in Night at the Museum 2, which was rubbish. I was not pleased. Tom in Sheffield. Also, put the word Jonas into your mobile and predictive text switched on, and look at the only other word available. I have a feeling I shouldn't have read that bit out now. No, it's okay. Good, okay, well...
Just do as I did. Put it there on the table and walk away from it.
Ken Loach and Eric Cantona on the programme next Friday.
It's fantastic.
Which will be something. Have you seen the movie?
No, I'm seeing it with you next Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's in 3D, apparently.
Now, that would be something.
It would be.
Eric Cantona and Ken Loach on this programme next Friday. Gavin in Edinburgh. Yeah. Dear Dr. Sam and Ivan, I was thrilled to hear on the programme last week that the Dear Doctor prefers Evil Dead 2 over Army of Darkness.
Yeah, of course.
I seem to be the only one of my friends who also subscribes to this opinion, and I thank you for proving me right.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to hearing the review of Drag Me to Hell. Hopefully it's a return to Raimi's horror roots.
OK, shall we start?
A number of people already calling it Drag Me to Hull, by the way.
So, can I have a bash?
So what?
Can I have a bash at the film?
Yes.
Are you going to carry on quipping for a while?
No. There's loads and loads of people who have already seen it.
Yeah, because it opened Wednesday.
And want to join in the conversation. But you obviously can go first.
So, okay, basically, Sam Raimi coming back to horror. The thing you need to remember about Sam Raimi is, of course, he's most famous for doing the Spider-Man movies, which are incredibly financially successful and which followed the route of number one, good, number two, much better, number three, total dog. In the same way as the things that he started with, which was the Evil Dead trilogy. Number one, really great. Number two, slightly better, amazingly. Number three, total dog, Army of Darkness, in any endings. It was an interesting thing with Evil Dead was that Sam Raimi always said that it was effectively a horror comedy. It was a Three Stooges movie with blood and guts standing in for custard pies, and that's exactly what it was. It's like kinetic slapstick, and there is such a thin line between comedy and horror, but it's very hard to get that equation right. I mean, I remember seeing The Evil Dead. I saw it in Notting Hill, cinema in Notting Hill, on a double bill with something else. I can't remember what it was. No, the first time I saw it, beg your pardon, was in Manchester. And there was that great sense that you were being really scared and really laughing at the same time, because it was the bits that were meant to be frightening were really frightening, but they were also really funny. It was that classic thing about build up tension, shriek, laugh. And it was, you know, you felt that your spirit was lifted by it. Of course, the irony with The Evil Dead was that the censors had a problem with it. James Furman, who was the head censor at the time, saw it for what it was, which is a horror comedy. But one of the board's officers said that they felt that they had been physically violated by the film. and insisted that it was cut for a cinema certificate. Then it came out on video and got caught up in the ridiculous video nasty scare. And I mention this because you were talking about a news story earlier on about a horror movie being cited. It's always the case that when moral panics happen, horror movies are the first thing that get dragged into, you know, as a possible explanation of social ills. Or let's look at horror movies. And in the 1980s, there was a terrible moral panic about video nasties, and a number of video nasties were prosecuted under the Obscene Publications Act. Definition of obscenity under British law is a tendency to deprave and corrupt a significant proportion of your likely audience. That is what defines something as being obscene. And amazingly, although a key case in Snaresbrook, which was fought by the distributors, that Evil Dead was found to be not guilty, all around the country, news agents and small video distributors pleaded guilty to distributing The Evil Dead, and it's consequently, it had a reputation. It actually had a legal reputation for being an obscene movie, a movie which was likely to deprave and corrupt a significant proportion of its intended audience. Which is unbelievable. Unbelievable, because the film itself is clearly not going to deprave and corrupt anybody at all. And yet, people who don't understand horror can misread those things. And I say that because I have somebody who, throughout my career, has so often seen horror movies referred to as depraving and corrupting, and has so rarely seen an example of that actually being the case.
Do we look at this as the pre-title sequence before you get to review the film?
We do. So what happens is Raimi then moves into the mainstream, but in the mainstream, he is still effectively doing the same kind of cinema as he did with Evil Dead, but he's doing it in a much more mainstream way. And by the time you get to Spider-Man 3, you can feel the weight of the fans, the weight of the budget, the weight of the comic heritage, the fact that we've got to get in another villain and then we're going to get the other guy in, and the movie's 2.5 hours long and it's baggy and it's all over the place. And of course, when Bruce Campbell came in, you know, we did say this, I mean, it's the worst of the Spider-Man movies because it was so encumbered by baggage. So with Drag Me to Hell, which he's made for his Ghost House Pictures label, who have done things like The Grudge, English language versions of The Grudge and Boogeyman, things that, which, you know, maybe not terrific. But he's described this as a ghost ride, as a fairground ride, as a fun, and that's exactly what it is. And in that good old way of saying, let's get rid of the baggage, let's make it in a stripped down way, let's do a good old nuts and bolts tension shriek laugh horror movie, kind of like I did with The Evil Dead. The difference now is that this is now seen to be very, very mainstream fare. And I was, all the time whilst I was watching Drag Me to Hell, I was asking myself this question. If this film had been on the video shelves in the 1980s, would some idiot have pulled it off the shelves and held it up in front of a magistrate's court and said it's potentially obscene? And you know what? They would have done. And all that demonstrates is that those moral panics only ever look sensible at the moment that they're happening. And a few years later, you realise that they are just moral panics. So, now, here we have the story. There is a young woman who works at a bank. At the beginning of the movie, she wants a promotion. She has to demonstrate that she can be tough. This is so hokey. A gypsy-like woman comes in and says, I need an extension on my loan, in a foreign accent. Alison Lohman says,
she
no.
sounds like the definition of subprime.
She does, yes.
Don't give money to her.
No, she's very subprime. And the banks say, no, we're going to repossess your house. At which point she curses the young woman and places a terrible hex on her.
Does she spit beer?
Okay. No, but what she does do is that she's... So there's one sequence when her teeth fall out and she attempts to gum the young woman to death, not remembering that her teeth are in. Anyway, in order for the plot to be adequately explained, our heroine goes to a seer, you know, a seer. Yeah, that's the word, isn't it? Seer, who explains the plot in Basil Exposition style. Here's the explanation.
I believe what plagues you is the Lamia.
Lamia, that's the word the old woman used.
The black goat, only summoned by gypsies for their darkest deeds. For the first 3 days, the Lamia appears as a nasty spirit that torments its victim. After that, it reveals itself to be a taker of souls and comes for the owner of the accursed object.
Accursed object? What object?
Something taken from the victim, cursed, and given back.
This? What if I just burn it?
I'm afraid no matter what condition the button is in, you would still be the owner. The Lamia would still come to take you.
Take me where? Then how do I get rid of this?
You could attempt to appease the spirit. The simplest way would be a blood offering. A small creature could be sacrificed. A chicken, perhaps.
No way! Look, I'm a vegetarian. I volunteer at the puppy shelter. I don't go around killing animals.
You will be surprised what you'll be willing to do when the Lamia comes for you.
And takes you.
to hell.
Now, look, as you can hear from that clip, right, it's light-hearted stuff. If you if you wrote down all the stuff that happens, as what happened in the video,
she's
Nasty
got a devilish
skit,
button, has she?
No, the button was taken off her and then given to her, so the button is now the symbol of the... And so she has to pass it on, like passing the runes. Dana Andrews said prunes gave him the runes, and passing them used lots of skills. Where does that come from?
No idea.
Rocky Horror Picture Show, referring to Night of the Demon. And so that's what she has to do. But the plot really is incredibly... It's like, you know, just a little bit of that, a little bit of that, a bit of EC Comics, a little bit of, you know, old mythology. It doesn't make any difference. Its basic story is there's stuff coming that's going to be bad. We know it's going to be bad because there was a prologue in which the bad stuff came for somebody else who doesn't really matter so much. And
was that
then,
someone else who wasn't sort of given the money that they needed?
No, that was just an innocent person. It's just a, you know, it's one of those prologue sequences in which you see what happens when the Lamia comes for you. The black-headed goat comes up from the pit of hell. And so then what transpires is essentially 90, 100 minutes of good romping Sam Raimi fun. Now, here's the thing. Sam Raimi does kinetic in a brilliant way.
What does that mean?
It does, you know, movable... physical comedy. So, like, I mean, I'd say in the same way that Buster Keaton was a great kinetic physical comedian, so is Sam Raimi. He understands the hilarious potential of somebody being really thrown against a wall. I mean, not thrown against a wall in a Bourne Identity shaky camera way, but thrown against the wall and going whoosh, boom, boom, like that. So everything happening, I mean, kind of Laurel and Hardy, well, actually, no, they're not so good, but back to Buster Keaton, or Charlie Chaplin, but without the pathos. He understands bong, ding, bang, you know.
Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, Tom and Jerry. And that's where all this horror comes from. It is exactly that thing that, you know, that three-year-olds laugh at Tom hitting Jerry over the head, you know, with the frying pan and the shape of Jerry being in the frying pan. That everyone understands that. When it comes to horror, people say, oh, somehow it's different because it's ghoulish and great. No, it's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same. Terribly innocent. Now, if there is a problem with Drag Me to Hell, it's that it isn't The Evil Dead. In that I never actually felt terrorised by it in the way that I did with The Evil Dead, which was so delicious, sitting there in the cinema thinking, I really don't know where this is going. I don't trust any of these people. I've never heard of them before, and I'm really creeped out. Now I know them. You know it's Sam Raimi and Ivan Raimi. You know they're nice people. You know they're the good guys. You know that really bad stuff isn't going to happen. So, in the, you know, and actually, in a funny way, the OPA prosecutions for The Evil Dead kind of made it even better, because it's a movie that the government tried to tell you you're not allowed to see. So that makes it even more exciting. But I saw it in a screening when they were doing the thing about they were filming members of the audience, you know, to see whether they shrieked and all that sort of stuff. And they did. It worked really well. You go there, it's a date movie. You go there with a date, ow, ow, bang, boom, boom. And that's
is that
how
that's the Jonas Brothers percussion track there.
And that's how the whole film plays out. And it's that lovely, innocent fun. It's not a masterpiece, and the script is very tinny. And it doesn't have quite the punky, grungy edge, the In the Woods edge that Evil Dead did, but I don't think anything really will. But as far as a mainstream, good, funfair, roller coaster, ghost house, fun house kind of ride is concerned, it really kept me smiling. And I came out of it with a big grin on my face and thought, good old Sam.
Don't forget, you can download the podcast. And if you really want more, on Thursday, Mark and his colleagues in the Dodge Brothers are going to be on this program. They're going to be playing live.
Apparently so. I've been in Japan while this was all happening because we're
booked. It was a difficult booking.
Was it?
Yep. But we managed to secure you at great cost, I think.
Is that facetious, sarcastic, or ironic? I really can't
all
tell.
All of them?
All of them above.
Why are the Dodge Brothers playing?
Because we're playing at the Barbican. There's a silent movie stuff going on at the Barbican, and so we're going to play along to, you know, silent movie stuff. And so we're going to come in and do a little bit of... And the idea with it is, you know, that... because I have talked about this before.
In brief...
OK, I'll be very quick. Mike Figgis said that the problem with cinema was when the talkies came along, what they did was they stopped cinema from being universal. And originally, cinema was melodrama, which is melody with drama, which is where that comes from. And, of course, music is the international language. And you make movies silent, and you play along to them, and anyone can understand them. And you can change the intertitles if you need to. As soon as people start talking in a specific language and you introduce the idea that a film is relevant only to a specific region. And Mike Figgis, the great example that he used was that when immigrants used to arrive in America at Ellis Island, they would be shown a silent film of life in New York, and it would explain enough to them to be able to then get off the boat and go, you're bored already, aren't you?
Wasn't that brief, was it?
It was under a minute, actually.
Drag Me to Hell correspondence. Nick Smith, Dear Darkness and Light. I'm hoping that the Doctor will get his teeth into this. I watched it last night in a jam-packed cinema in Islington, and although clearly not The Exorcist, it was great to see and hear that everyone was having a rather excellent time.
Exactly.
For once, other people's noise in the cinema wasn't a distraction, but warmly welcomed and shared like a gig.
Yep.
Fear and laughter at the same time is an extremely hard trick to pull off. Sam Raimi is clearly a master at this and has lost none of his touch since Evil Dead franchise. Loads of big scares, outrageous effects and tongue-in-cheek references to the Dead series everywhere for the fanboys and girls. Massive on entertainment. The only problem was no cameo from Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, and it's funny because I did expect Bruce to be in there. Bruce has been in almost everything. As you know, he was most recently, he was thanked in, what was it called? Was it Nude Bowling or something? Or was that Ivan Raimi? Was
I don't
it?
Remember
you no, Ivan Raimi was thanked in Nude Bowling Party, but Bruce came in because he was, you know, he made My Name is Bruce, which was great. But he was in, you know, Killer Cucumbers or something more recently.
Tim in London, Dear Bodie and Johnny Utah, saw a preview of Drag Me to Hell last night, one of the most brilliantly directed films of the past decade. I'm not a horror geek, but I've long admired Sam's work in everything from Darkman and The Quick and the Dead to Spider-Man.
The Quick and the Dead, he liked both of those films.
The Quick and the Dead, Spider-Man. It's a double bill showing. It's hard to think of another director who possesses such total mastery of his specific genre. Everyone is talking about the gore, but the way Raimi uses simple devices like a floating handkerchief, shadows and ordinary houseflies to terrify viewers is amazing. Rory Steele, BA Japanese in History. I saw Drag Me to Hell last Sunday featuring a Q&A with the director and the stars. As a fan of the Evil Dead films, I was relieved to discover Sam Raimi hasn't lost his touch. With so many contemporary terror pictures wrapped up in being as gritty, grueling and torture-filled as can be, Drag Me to Hell was a welcome return to horror as an enjoyable thrill ride.
Exactly. And like I said, the horror-comedy thing, it's not horror and then comedy. It's that the scares are funny.
Dear Peter Parker and Dr. Octavia says, Nick, Sam Raimi always includes his yellow 1973 Oldsmobile Delta 88 in his films, even The Quick, and also The Dead. Did the good doctor spot it in Drag Me to Hell?
I didn't, no.
Esther, in her sunny garden in sunny Dublin, Dear Tetsuo and the Iron Man, went to see Sam Raimi's latest masterpiece last night. 'Twas absolutely thrilling, the relentless... I can't do that. Had me squirming in my seat. My question for the good doctor is, has he ever seen any goat stealing a scene the way that the cheerfully grinning goat in Drag Me to Hell does?
No, it's great goat use. That movie gives good goat.
Is it the best use of a goat in a film?
It is. There's killer sheep in Black Sheep, but that's as far as the outstanding goat moment is concerned. I mean... somebody will invoke the revenge of Billy the Kid, but let's not go there.
Anyways, absolutely loads of stuff. Overwhelmingly people saying... It's really good fun,
and it's good, and it's healthy, and it's good for you. Horror movies are good for you.
What else is new?
There's three things. Let me just sort of belt through them quickly. Fugitive Pieces, which is an adaptation of the novel by Anne Michaels, which was described by somebody as the greatest work ever written. I haven't read that, but I read her other book, and I found it really insufferable. It's a very complex tale. It's about a young kid who, at the very beginning of the film, his family are taken off by the Nazis. He is taken on by a Greek archaeologist. We then see him grown up, Stephen Delane, and... the movie exists in two timescales, the past and the present. In the present, he's a writer attempting to come to terms with his awful past and falling out in his relationship with Rosamund Pike because she's just too happy and he can't bear to be around her happiness. And it's a very difficult thing because Anne Michaels is clearly a very, very poetic writer. There are lots of sort of quotable bon mots in the film, maybe too many. And the film suffers from being terribly readerly, in that, like the reader, it has a reverence for its text and it has certain things about it that are clearly heartfelt and, occasionally touching and sort of spine-tingling, but somehow it never really works as a film. It's interesting. It's been around. It was first seen in Toronto, I think, in late 2007, and it's taken a long time to get out, and I can see why. I mean, there was a lovely review of it by Roger Ebert when it first came out, saying it was an extraordinary film about hope, because in many ways it's a movie about the Holocaust for which the central line is... there are two sides to everything, and you can either choose to see the side which destroys or you can see the side which creates. And it is a film about, you know, goodness, and it is a film that has clearly heart and soul. It's also a film, however, in which people roll peaches over each other's skin and is sensuous in a way that I find slightly toe-curling, saved for me by, and I can't pronounce his name, Rad Shabigia. He's a fantastic Croatian actor, and I've never had a run at his name before. He was in Eyes Wide Shut, but he's absolutely brilliant. He's marvellous in the film, and he's really, really famous. Somebody tell, please let me know how I pronounce his name so I can say it properly. R-A-D-E, and then Serbedzija, I think it must be. Do you know? Let's call the whole thing off.
I would obviously help you.
But the film itself, I have to say, nothing really to write home about.
If you roll peaches over your skin, that's a good
essential
thing.
Well, apparently it is, yeah. Have you never done that? Never felt so sensitive. You know that thing in Nine and a Half
Weeks?
I think
I'd be allergic to it. My skin would probably come out in a rash.
Mickey Rourke is so excited by the prospect of Kim Basinger that he starts to throw the entire contents of the fridge at her. It's like that, only art.
Right.
Okay.
It's not doing it for me. Really.
Two other things which I want to mention. Fermat's Room, which is a Spanish thriller, which is a cute little thing. It's like Cube meets A Beautiful Mind. It's four guests, three mathematicians and an inventor, are brought together into a room where they've all been invited to solve the great...
Fermat's Last Theorem.
Exactly. But they're going to be given a series of riddles. Okay? Somebody who we assume is the host, played by Federico Lupi. Let us all bow down. Federico Lupi, of course, you will know the end of Pan's Labyrinth and in Kronos. Just a wonderful actor. Whenever you see Federico Lupi's name on anything, go see it, because he will always be worth
watching. What does he do in Pan's Labyrinth?
At the very end, he's the king of the underworld.
Oh, him?
Yeah, him.
Not a big role, then.
Pardon me?
Not a big role.
Well, he could... You know, he could walk across a set of traffic lights and make it a big role. Anyway, Federico Lupi comes in, then he's called away, leaving the other four people to realise that they have one problem to solve every 60 seconds. And if they don't solve the problem, the walls of the room they are in will move in because they are on hydraulic presses. So it's like, you know that film Saw? That horrible film Saw,
well,
right?
Well, I've read of it.
Yeah, well, it's like Slide Rule. Okay, there's people trapped in a thing, and rather than doing things that are sort of grungy and horrible, they have to solve problems. And then, of course, it all turns out they all actually were somehow interconnected, and they have to solve the big problem, which is why are they all together in the room?
And why are they all together in the room?
See the film, because it's directed by these two people who feature film first time, as they come from television. It's a good idea. It sounds like it might run out of steam, but it doesn't. It was gripping and entertaining, and in the same way as Cube was, used a very, very small and simple set to an end which was entirely jolly and worked very well and didn't outstay its welcome. And I thought it was a good idea, well done. And as I said, yes, not Saw, Slide Rule. And finally, I want to mention this thing, Sleep Furiously, which is...
Small S,
an ambient documentary about Welsh farming community. It's directed by Gideon Copple. And it is, on the one hand, a documentary, although we've seen so much recently in which documentaries consist of people standing in front of the cameras and holding forth. You know, it's the kind of the Michael Moore, Nick Broomfield approach to documentary filmmaking, which I think was worn very, very thin. This is just a beautiful portrait of a community which is kind of facing extinction. The school is being closed down, they've lost the bus services, and there's a recurrent image of a mobile library driving through this hillside. And it's beautiful. It's produced, shot and directed by the same guy, and it has music by the Aphex Twin. Dun, 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 dun. You know that piece of piano music?
No.
Yes, you do.
Okay.
I'm not singing it very well. It's really funny because in the end it is closer to being a poem. You know, I said Anne Michaels wasn't writing a novel as much as she was writing a sort of novel-length poem. Well, this is like a lyrical, visual poem. There's shots of, you know, people of sheep herding, shepherding, you know, dogs rounding up sheep. There's shots of rolling hillsides. There's shots of clouds with the sun shining through in a way which is deeply sinister and yet very, very beautiful. There's one marvellous sequence in which we see a woman conducting a choir, and she's conducting them with the facial expressions and arms. It was just wonderful to look at, and it is a genuinely observational piece of work. You think about it at the beginning, you think, how exciting and enthralling can this be? You know, the answer is very exciting and enthralling in that way, because it's a tonal thing. It is to do with getting the tone and the atmosphere right. And it is, in some ways, a sort of a fighting cry, because it's about, look, you know, communities in retreat, these sort of things. But it's the fighting is kind of pacifist fighting. It's arguing for...
That's
something.
Not fighting, then?
Well, it is, actually. That's what Gandhi would say.
But pacifists don't fight, they argue.
It's Gandhi's answer for the fighting documentary. It is an ambient tone poem, and it is entertaining and lovely, and I liked it very much.
However, the movie of the week, one would imagine...
Drag Me to Hell. Drag Me to Hull, and then after that, Drag Me to Hell. Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live